Hey folks, welcome to First Thursday. This is Labor Relations Information Systems monthly podcast on recent developments that are shaping the public safety workplace. My name is Will Aitchison. I'll be your host, and boy, do we have a lineup for you today. In the last week, we've had three very significant decisions from the United States Supreme Court on issues concerning free speech and the right to privacy. Three decisions that have, I think, a lot of potential for future impact. And before I get into those, though, I'd be remiss if I didn't remind you we've got a couple of seminars coming up that you should check out by going to our website, LRIS.com. We've got a seminar in September on grievances and arbitration, how grievances are written and processed, and how an arbitrator decides who wins a grievance. And then in November, we have our annual seminar on internal affairs and critical incidents. Both of those seminars will be in Las Vegas, and hope to see you there. Okay, now on to the podcast, and let's talk about this trio of United States Supreme Court decisions. And the first one, we actually have to go back a little ways on. In 2006, the Supreme Court decided a case called Garcetti versus Sabalos. This is a case, it's later been referred to by some fairly sober people as being a revolution in constitutional law. In Garcetti, what the Supreme Court seemed to say, what a lot of people, including a lot of lower courts, thought it said, was that public employees basically don't have free speech rights with respect to matters concerning their job. Kind of loosely put, if whatever the speech was, and by speech, it could be talking, like I'm doing now, or it could be writing a memorandum or writing something to a third party. If speech, even loosely, arose out of the employee's job, courts were applying the Garcia rule to find that speech completely unprotected by the First Amendment. And since 2006, we have seen decisions that are almost striking in the types of speech that they hold unprotected by the First Amendment. There have been cases, for example, that employees who are reporting corruption through their chain of command are unprotected by the First Amendment because, of course, it's part of any employee's job to report corruption. There have been cases that employees who have reported the misconduct of fellow employees and later been retaliated against are unprotected by the First Amendment. And of course, that's because it's part of any employee's job to report the misconduct of a fellow employee. There are several notable police cases like that, where a police officer said, hey, I think Officer A has used excessive force. And then the allegation later is Officer A is best friends with the chief, who promptly fires the officer who reports it. And courts have held that that speech, because it arises out of the job, is unprotected under the Garcetti rule. So it's the Garcetti rule has produced this result that there's been, for the last 8 years, virtually no protection to public safety employees for speech concerning the job. What happened last week? Well, it's a case called Lane versus Franks. And in the case, the case has pretty straightforward facts. I'll tell them very briefly here. Lane turns out to be a fellow in, it works for state government in Alabama. And he's hired as a director of a youth training program. When he gets on the job, he finds out very quickly that there is an employee, her name is Suzanne Schmitz, and she also happens to be a state legislator, but she's an employee of this training agency, only she never shows up for work. And Lane has a problem with that. He orders her to come to work. She says, no. Wonderful words. I'm going to continue to serve the program in the same manner as I have in the past. Lane says, okay, Maybe you didn't understand me correctly. You're fired. Schmitz is an at-will employee. Schmitz then gets very angry, and she tells others that if Lane ever comes to the legislature to ask for money for the program, she would tell him, you're fired, and basically says that she's going to figure out a way to retaliate against Lane. Well, all of the news reports concerning this swirl around, and some of them get the FBI's attention. Schmitz ends up getting indicted on 4 counts of mail fraud and 4 counts of theft because her program, the one she didn't show up for, her program got federal funds, and eventually she's convicted. Lane testifies in the grand jury that indicts Schmitz, and he testifies at her trial. Later on, after all that is behind everybody, there's a budget shortfall at the state level, and the director of the program, the person to whom Lane is reporting, the director is actually the president of the college, sends layoff notices to 29 employees, including Lane. He later rescinds 27 of the layoff notices, but ends up laying off Lane. Lane sues, saying, look, you're retaliating against me for the lawful exercise of my First Amendment rights. You're retaliating against me, not only because I reported what Schmitz did, but also because I testified truthfully in the grand jury and in the trial. That lawsuit goes through the lower court system. The lower court throws out the lawsuit, says, look, Garcetti, it's part of Lane's job to do these things. Roughly, kind of, sort of, part of his job to testify truthfully before an inquiry into corruption in his very own agency. Therefore, since it's part of his job, his speech isn't protected. It's speech as an employee, not speech as a citizen. And then the Supreme Court takes review on the case. And the court says to the world, we really didn't mean you to interpret Garcetti in the way you have. We never meant it to be that broadly. In the words of the court, the mere fact that a citizen's speech concerns information acquired by virtue of his public employment doesn't transform the speech into speech as an employee, rather than speech as a citizen. The critical question under Garcetti, says the Supreme Court, is whether the speech itself is, and these are going to be the key words, mark this prediction, these are going to be the key words for years to come. The critical question is whether the speech at issue is itself ordinarily within the scope of an employee's duties, not whether it merely concerns those duties. The court goes on and has lots of nice words about the importance of public employees reporting corruption, that, you know, this is what we expect public employees to do, and therefore the First Amendment should protect this sort of speech. The court talks at some length about the fact that lower courts have been really misinterpreting Garcetti. I'm just struck by the fact that that's just a little bit of intellectual fudging there, to tell you the truth. You can go back to the Garcetti opinion itself, and it was a very vigorous dissenting opinion written by the 4 what are called liberal judges on the court. And the justice who wrote that dissenting opinion predicted that precisely the sorts of cases would arise under Garcetti, as eventually did. This was not a mystery that Garcetti was going to be interpreted this way, but finally the Supreme Court has had enough and has reined in Garcetti and pulled it back. We're going to see now years of litigation over how far the door is open. Let's take some of the cases that have been losers under Garcetti and think about them in light of the new words of Lane. So, for example, there's a case involving a a police officer in Ohio. He was a canine officer, and he sent a memo through the chain of command complaining about cutbacks in training in the canine program. He was warning that there would be potential liability from dog bites because of the cutback in training. He was fired as a result of sending that memo, and a court found his speech to be part of the job and therefore unprotected under Garcetti. Does that come out the same way under Lane? Is it ordinarily part of the job of a canine officer to write a memo about training deficits? Maybe not. Maybe that will be protected speech in the future. I actually think it will be. What about testifying truthfully, not in court, we know that's protected under Lane, but what about where the truthful testimony is in the internal affairs process? Under Garcetti, we had several lower court decisions saying, look, it's part of a public employee's job to testify truthfully in internal affairs. Therefore, they can be fired for testifying truthfully in internal affairs without any First Amendment implications. Do those cases come out the same way under Lane? I don't think so. Unfortunately, because Lane is written in very broad strokes, it's going to take years of individual cases, dozens and dozens of cases, until we find out precisely how much that door that was slammed so firmly shut in Garcetti has now been opened again in Lane. All right. Let's move from speech to privacy and the Supreme Court's decision in Riley versus California. Why is this one important? It's important because we are starting to see practices develop in a number of public safety agencies, perhaps more so police than firefighters, but I've seen it in both. Practices develop where in the course of a disciplinary investigation, or even a criminal investigation, the employer is demanding that the employee produce their personal cell phone for examination. Sometimes it's just more of a prophylactic measure than anything else. We want to make sure you didn't say anything. Sometimes the allegations of misconduct may relate to what the employee has posted on the internet. And so the employer is trying to track that down and ask to see the employee's a cell phone. Sometimes the allegations of impropriety may relate directly to cell phone use. For example, I was involved in a situation a while back where the officer was texting at the scene of an arrest, and a suspect, and consequently the department, later wanted the officer's cell phone to see what those texts said. So we're starting to see these practices come up where the employer is demanding access to the employee's cell phone. What we haven't seen from the U.S. Supreme Court is any comprehensive Fourth Amendment, that's search and seizure, privacy decision involving cell phones. We haven't seen that until last week in the case of Riley versus California, and now we have, and what a bombshell of a decision. So Riley is a criminal case. Riley is a guy, he stopped for a traffic violation, and that leads to his arrest on weapons charges. For those of you who don't do law enforcement on a daily basis, law enforcement officers have the right to conduct what's called a search incident to an arrest. When they arrest somebody, they have the right to search their pockets and things like that. It's basically a safety-related type search, sometimes sort of an inventory-type search. And it's a search that doesn't require a warrant or a probable cause. So the police department, in this case, ends up seizing Riley's cell phone. It's in his pants pockets, one of his pants pockets. The officer who seizes it accesses information on the phone and notice the repeated use of a term associated with a particular street gang. So the cell phone's then turned over to the gang detective, who looks at the phone's digital contents. He looks at photographs, looks at videos, and then the state decides state of California decides Riley probably killed somebody, and they charge him in connection with a shooting that occurred a few weeks earlier. And they end up seeking an enhanced sentence based on Riley's gang membership. So those are the charges against Riley. And of course, Riley's lawyer, first thing, moves to suppress all of the evidence that the police obtained from the cell phone. And by a 9-0 vote, the Supreme Court sides with Riley and suppresses the evidence from the cell phone. The court has to confront the fact that several of its decisions on searches incident to an arrest suggested, actually, that there'd be no limitations on the types of property that a law enforcement agency could look at in a search incident to an arrest. And the court's dealing with those issues is pretty interesting because the court says, hey, you know, all those prior decisions, they don't neatly apply to cell phones. The court refers to cell phones, and here's a quote. I love this quote. Cell phones as such a pervasive and insistent part of daily life that the proverbial visitor from Mars might conclude they were an important feature of human anatomy. Sounds like the Supreme Court doesn't particularly like cell phone use. A smartphone of the sort taken from Riley, says the court, was unheard of 10 years ago. A significant majority of American adults now own such phones. And the bottom line, the court says, is, look, those rationales that we had for not requiring warrants for searches incident to an arrest, that there might be some sort of danger to the officer from a weapon that the suspect might have, or there might be the potential for destruction of evidence, those rationales don't exist when the search is of digital data. The court is clearly concerned with the scope of these sorts of searches. The court says a search of the information on a cell phone bears little resemblance to the type of brief physical search that we have considered in the past. The court says, look, the term cell phone itself is misleading. What these devices are mini computers that also happen to have the capacity to be used as a telephone. They could just as easily be called cameras, video players, Rolodexes, calendars, tape recorders, libraries, diaries, albums, televisions, maps, or newspapers. And I'm going to go on this a little bit, but it's only because the court goes on and on. Listen to what the court says here about cell phones. One of the most notable distinguishing features of modern cell phones is their immense storage capacity. Before cell phones, a search of a person was limited by physical realities, intended as a general matter to constitute only a narrow intrusion on privacy. But the intrusion on privacy is not physically limited in the same way when it comes to cell phones. The current top-selling smartphone has a standard capacity of 16 gigabytes, and that translates to millions of pages of text, thousands of pictures, or hundreds of videos. And the court says, look, what this does is give us immense implications for the right to privacy. You can find out all sorts of stuff about somebody from a cell phone that you couldn't find out even if you looked in their wallet. And therefore, what we're going to say is, in order to examine the contents of a cell phone, you need both probable cause that the contents will contain evidence of a crime, and you're going to need to obtain a warrant. All right, let's take this case out of the criminal setting and put it in the administrative setting. How is this going to apply in disciplinary investigations? And for this, let me firmly shrug my shoulders just a little bit and say, it's hard to tell, but I think the practice of routinely asking employees to produce their cell phones, that is a practice that is fraught with risk. And if I were an employer, I wouldn't be doing it. I wouldn't be asking employees, or worse yet, ordering employees to produce their cell phones in the course of an internal affairs investigation. And if I did, even if I wanted to go ahead and do that, I would darn well make sure that the digital intrusion on that phone was as limited as possible. That if, for example, what you're looking for is a photograph that was taken on July 2nd, 2014, that the only digital intrusion into that phone would be looking for a photograph, B, taken on July 2nd, 2014. But as I just indicated, I wouldn't even get there. If I'm an employer, I do my disciplinary investigations without demanding the cell phones of employees, unless there's probable cause and the ability to get a warrant. Now, I know this is very cautious advice, but I think the implications here are pretty significant. You have this whopper of a decision from the Supreme Court saying, hey, there's privacy rights that are involved here, and employers' potential liability under Section 1983 of the Civil Rights Act could be pretty high, given the breadth of the Supreme Court's opinion in Riley. Okay, on to the third of our blockbuster Supreme Court decisions. It was quite a week reading those opinions, I've got to say. And this one, and this is the Supreme Court's Fair Share decision. I've already done a small podcast on it, but now there's been a little bit more opportunity to reflect on the case. This is one where I ended up getting kind of blown away by the national media reports on this. And the media reports from both sides of the political spectrum, from the liberal side and the conservative side, I listened to these reports and I wondered whether I was actually reading the same opinion that they were. Because the reports that you heard were that the Supreme Court has declared Fair Share unconstitutional, or the Supreme Court has greatly cut back the rights of public employee labor organizations. And in fact, I see this case really as a best case result for labor, not against labor. Okay, so let's talk about it. What's this all about? First of all, let's talk about Fair Share and kind of the litigation history of Fair Share, and then how we got to this decision in the last week. And the decision is called Harris versus Franks. Fair Share has been around with us in the public sector since we really since we had our first public sector collective bargaining laws. Those laws started to get adopted in the 1960s, really the heyday of them was from about 1968 until 1976. That's when most public sector collective bargaining laws were adopted. And when they were adopted, many states, and I think the count is now 20 states, allowed labor organizations and employers to negotiate what's called a fair share membership clause. Sometimes these are called agency membership clauses or the fees collected under them, fair share fees or fair share assessments or agency fees. You hear all those terms used, and really they all mean the same thing. And what do they mean? What fair share membership means is that someone can't be compelled to be a member of a labor union. But what they can be compelled to do is to pay their fair share of the costs incurred by the union in negotiating and administering the contract. And this is born out of, I think, kind of root notions of fairness. If somebody is in the bargaining unit, they will receive the benefits of the union's negotiations efforts, right? They'll get the wage schedule the union negotiates for, the health insurance, and everything like that. And if they're in the bargaining unit, the union has a duty of fair representation to them, a duty that may require the union to consider referring to arbitration a grievance on behalf of this employee. And those obligations, or that obligation, the duty of fair representation and the fact that the union bargains for the employee, that obligation exists without regard to whether or not that individual is a member. And so what Fair Share does is to allow the union to charge non-members, not full dues, because there's some things that unions do that don't have anything to do with negotiating the contract. They may hold a Christmas party or a summer picnic or publish a newspaper or, you know, give flowers to people who are in the hospital, engage in politics. None of those have anything to do with bargaining. So Fair Share assessments are less than union dues, usually 70, 80, 90% of union dues, but they recoup for the union what the union has spent on a pro rata basis representing this employee. That's the notion behind these Fair Share clauses in collective bargaining agreements. By the way, states that have declared Fair Share illegal, those are states that are the so-called right-to-work states. That's all that phrase means, right-to-work, is that unions can't negotiate with an employer to compel non-members to pay their fair share of the costs of negotiating and administering the contract. That's what a right-to-work state is. Well, early on in the days of public sector unionism, the Supreme Court had to decide whether or not fair share was constitutional, whether there were any free speech, First Amendment implications to a fair share clause. And in a case that's been around since 1977, it's called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education, the Supreme Court said fair share is constitutional. There are some overriding public interests behind fair share. The Supreme Court indicated it got this free rider problem, you know, that unions have to go ahead and represent somebody even if they're a non-member, and why should that person be getting a free ride on the back of all union members? The Supreme Court said that's a legitimate state concern, and that really you're not forcing too much speech by making or forcing a fair share contribution where that fair share contribution doesn't include political activities and other free speech types of activities. So that's been with us. The Abood case has been with us since 1977. So what's going on now? Well, what's going on now is really the coalescence, I think, of two different things. The first is we have a very activist Supreme Court, the most activist Supreme Court really that we've had in any of our lifetimes. And by activist, I don't mean left wing, right wing, or anything like that. I mean the willingness of the court to overturn either its prior decisions or to overturn statutes, declare statutes either illegal or unconstitutional. We've never seen a court like we have in the last 15 years that has been as activist as the one we have right now. And the second thing that kind of defines the court right now on labor issues is it is a very strongly pro-employer court. By my count, and I try to track these things, over the last 12 years, we've had 43 decisions involving labor issues, management versus a union or management versus an employee. And in 41 of those 43 decisions, the court has ruled for the employer. Now, 41 out of 43, that's not an accident. That's an ideology. And that's where our court is right now. There is a 5-judge majority on the court that is very, very sympathetic to employer issues and very unsympathetic to employee issues. So that's one of the two developments that we've had that got us last week's case. And the other is the rise of an outfit out of Virginia known as the Right to Work Foundation. And they've got several subsidiary foundations as well. This is a foundation that has as its mission the end to public unionism. They just simply don't believe in that public employees should have the right to collectively bargain. And their narrower focus is They want to end Fair Share. That's the name, the Right to Work Foundation. Who's behind the foundation? Well, it's the usual people you might expect. They've received a lot of funding from the Koch brothers and received funding from the Walton family that owns Walmarts and the like. You kind of expect who would make these contributions. And the Right to Work Foundation has been very, very active in this way. What happened to produce last week's decision, and the case is called Harris versus Quinn, is the Right to Work Foundation took a case up to the Supreme Court, case out of Illinois, and it took it as the vehicle to get Fair Share declared unconstitutional. The Right to Work Foundation clearly made the judgment that we can count to five. We know there are five conservative justices on this court who we think will rule in our favor and declare Fair Share unconstitutional. And in fact, lots of people thought that. It wasn't just the Right to Work Foundation. Labor organizations thought it. I mean, there are national labor organizations that had plans in the works as to what to do when Fair Share ended as a result of Harris versus Quinn. I mean, a lot of people thought they could count to five, and I'll confess, I'm one of them as well, and thought that we would see the end of Fair Share because of the ideological bent of this court. And then Harris versus Quinn gets argued in January, and a kind of a shocking thing happens. One of the five justices, and the most reliably conservative of the justices, Antonin Scalia, makes some comments during the oral argument that indicate he's not completely comfortable with overturning Fair Share, that he kind of understands the free rider issue. And at least initially, people came away from that oral argument a little bit confused as to what was going to happen. And then as time went by, you saw people kind of seeping back to their original positions, anticipating that the court would overturn the Abood decision and end Fair Share. And then we kept waiting for the decision to come down. The Supreme Court issues all decisions before the end of June. The last Monday in June typically is the last day that it issues its opinions. And we would see opinions come down and opinions that were in cases that were orally argued after Harris versus Quinn, and they would come down. They'd be significant cases, but no decision in Harris versus Quinn. What in the world's going on? And usually when the Supreme Court delays issuing an opinion like this, in a case that's not all that legally complicated, and this is not legally complicated compared to, you know, some of the other cases the Supreme Court has had, usually what's going on is one of two things. First of all, there may be a lot of justices writing opinions in the case. So you may have, instead of a majority opinion, they can't get five votes for anything, so they have a plurality opinion that goes one way, and then some concurring opinions and a bunch of dissenting opinions. So there's a lot of opinions, and that may delay it. The other thing is you may have initially a majority in the case where when they see the draft of the opinion, the majority falls apart. Some of the justices who were part of the majority all of a sudden say, we're not part of that anymore. So the more delay we saw, the more we wondered what in the world was going on. And those questions were answered last Monday. And what the court ended up saying was pretty interesting. First of all, it said, by the way, it's the same 5-4 majority. So the five conservative judges in the majority here, the four liberal judges dissenting. The five-judge majority says, first of all, we understand that we're being asked to overturn Abood. No kidding, right? I mean, that's what the Right to Work Foundation asked the court to do. That's what the court explicitly asked the parties to write briefs about. And that's what all these amicus curiae briefs, friend of the court briefs, address. No kidding. Anyway, back to the court. We understand we're asked to overturn Abood, but we're not going to do that. It's not because we love Abood. Because we have some problems with some of the theoretical underpinnings of Abood. The court takes about 3 pages in its opinion to attack Abood, but we're not going to overturn it. Instead, what we're going to find is that the employees in this case, these Illinois employees, they're not employee enough like to have fair share apply to them. Whoa, what does that mean? Well, what that means is, the court says, these are not like other state employees. These are home health care workers. They work for patients, or as the court calls them, customers. They don't report to a work site. They report to the person's house. The customer, not the state, hires and fires them. And there's no restriction on the customer's ability to do either of those things. These employees have no right to bargain over their wages, and they don't. They do not enjoy other benefits that state employees enjoy. Pensions, health care are 2 main ones that are mentioned by the court. And the customer sets the job duties for these workers, not the state. And the customer supervises the employees. These are not employee enough like to have fair share applied to them. These are unusual employees. And therefore, we're going to find that the application of fair share to these employees does violate their First Amendment rights because there's not enough of a nexus behind these basic principles of fair share to this type of employee. Of course, the 4 dissenting judges say what you might expect them to say, which is, look, they're still state employees, and they still are subject to a collective bargaining agreement. May not say everything most contracts say, but they're still subject to it. And really, aren't you being classist here? Aren't you drawing a line between this type of state employee and other types of state employees? Well, that's what the dissenting judges say. So what happened here? I mean, we don't know. The wall of secrecy in front of the Supreme Court is probably as strong as the wall of secrecy around the exterior of NSA. But I think it's a pretty fair guess that at least one of the 5 judges in the majority wasn't willing to go along with the ending of fair share. At least one of the 5 judges, if not more. I think what happened is that that 5-justice conservative majority fell apart on this issue, and they cobbled together the best that they could, which was a ruling that these employees weren't subject to fair share. Now, what this tells us, of course, is that the composition of the court is an incredibly important issue. We've never had as divided a Supreme Court as we have now. It's not just labor issues, these 5-4 decisions. You see these decisions all the time on virtually everything. And we've never had, as I mentioned earlier, we've never had an activist court like we do now, striking down regulations and statutes and prior decisions of the Supreme Court. This 5-4 majority of the court, these 9 justices, this is one of our oldest courts as well. We have justices in their 80s. And it's very likely that whoever the next president is going to get at least 2 and maybe 4 or 5 appointments to the Supreme Court. And depending on who that president is, we could see this decision entirely changed. We could see Abood, of course, either reinforced or rejected. We could see the court and the court's philosophies, general philosophies about the importance of prior decisions. We could see all of that stuff hugely change or hugely be reinforced in a way that, again, because of how polarized this court is, I just don't think we've seen in our lifetimes. This is going to be an interesting time to be watching the Supreme Court. I realize that after those 3 blockbuster decisions we have from the Supreme Court, that anything else I say in this podcast is kind of kind of pale by comparison. But there have been other cases, and there's three that I do want to spend just a little bit of time on, not a ton of time. Three that I want to bring up for different points of emphasis. First is a decision coming out of the California Court of Appeals, and it involves the question of whether or not pre-shift warm-up exercises, physical fitness routines, whether or not injuries suffered during those pre-shift exercise routines are compensable injuries under the workers' compensation system. And the California Court of Appeals, believe it or not, answers that question yes, at least under these facts. And what were the facts? Well, the facts involved a sergeant by the name of Daniel Young, who worked for the Butte County Sheriff's Department as a corrections sergeant. The Sheriff's Department stresses that corrections officers have to be in good physical condition. The words of the Sheriff's Department's rules are that they have to be in shape, good enough shape, to handle the strenuous physical contacts often required of a law enforcement officer. The job description refers to the requirement to catch and subdue hostile individuals, to walk, run, lift, and climb, and things like that. So, in other words, the county stresses physical fitness for corrections officers. It also requires corrections officers to complete periodic training exercises each year, and many of those, as you might imagine, involve physical requirements of the job. So they could be pairing off with a partner, taking turns being the aggressor, practicing control holds and physical control techniques, takedown techniques, and self-defense and offensive methods. All of those things happen in the department's training sessions. The department doesn't give its officers any opportunity to participate in a fitness regimen during work hours, and it doesn't really give anybody guidance on, you know, that you need to be doing this type of workout in order to meet our requirements. So the corrections officers kind of left to their own devices to come up with their own fitness routines. Young's involved doing warm-up calisthenics, including jumping jacks, and then he turned to a more rigorous workout on his elliptical or a multi-station weight machine. So in January of 2012, while he's off duty, getting ready to go to work, Young is doing his normal fitness routine. He's doing warm-up jumping jacks, and he falls. And when he falls, he suffers an extremely stabbing pain in his left knee. He files a workers' compensation claim for his injuries. The department turns him down, and that's the case that ends up with the California Court of Appeals. And the court, as I mentioned, ends up saying, look, this is a compensable injury. Why? The court says the department doesn't give its corrections sergeants an opportunity to exercise or maintain their fitness activities during work hours, and it doesn't provide guidance as to the type of exercises or activities considered appropriate for maintaining the requisite level of physical fitness. Accordingly, and here's the court, it is objectively reasonable for Young to believe the department expected him to engage in an off-duty exercise regimen to maintain his physical fitness. It's also objectively reasonable to believe the department would have expected the specific activity of warm-up calisthenics, particularly for a 64-year-old guy such as Young. And jumping jacks, says the court, are a common calisthenic exercise. And when we put all this together, there is a, and I'm quoting again, substantial nexus between the department's requirement that corrections sergeants maintain good physical condition and Young's specific off-duty activity of warm-up calisthenics. Therefore, his injuries are compensable under the workers' compensation laws. Interesting. California courts have always been a little bit more generous with respect to the application of workers' compensation laws to public safety officers There are some cases where the court has found compensable off-duty training for a mandatory physical fitness exercise, even a physical fitness incentive plan. There are some cases where courts have found that officers who are subpoenaed to testify in court, who are injured driving to court, that those are compensable injuries. California courts have always been somewhat more generous than others. Would this result apply in other states? Maybe, because of the specific job requirements for the employer, or put into place by the employer. This emphasis on physical fitness in those job requirements. Interesting case. All right, our next case, not a traditional labor case, it's a public records case. But it's one of the first ones I've seen out there, and I thought I'd talk a little bit about it. This concerns dash cam videos, and it comes to us from the Seattle Police Department. Since 2007, all of the department's patrol fleet has been equipped with in-car videos and sound recording equipment. Eventually, a local television station makes a request under Washington's public records law, not only for the logs of all video recordings, but wants to see the recordings themselves. The department denies the request, and the reporter sues. And there we get our case. It goes up to the Washington Court of Appeals, and has to, the court has to decide whether or not these sorts of recordings are subject to any exemption that would prohibit them from being disclosed. And in particular, this case involves a law in Washington known as Washington's Privacy Act, which exempts from disclosure sound or video recordings until final disposition of any criminal or civil litigation, which arises from the event or events that were recorded. The police department, Seattle Police Department, argued in court that that meant that dash cam videos in and of themselves are not disclosable, and the court refused to go along with it. The court said, look, the only reason for this exemption in the Privacy Act is that there's pending litigation. In the absence of pending litigation, there's no exemption in the public records law that would shield these recordings. They are public records, and therefore they need to be disclosed. The bottom line of the court's opinion is that the Privacy Act is a limited exception to disclosure under the public records law, but it is one that applies only when there is actual pending litigation. Now, this issue, what do you do with all of these recordings that in particular law enforcement agencies are now making, and are now making passively, these passively in the sense that you don't even have to activate the recorder. They could be cameras that are on the dashboard, they could be on the grill of a car, they could be on an officer's uniform. The issue of privacy rights concerning these recordings is really swirling around in a lot of state legislatures right now. And this is one that finds one of the usual major players in these events, the American Civil Liberties Union, finds the ACLU struggling to take a coherent position. Because, of course, these recordings don't just catch police officers doing bad things, which is sometimes the way, you hear these recordings described. What they mostly capture is suspects doing bad things. And sometimes they catch suspects being severely injured or even killed. And sometimes they capture suspects committing crimes and hurting innocent third parties. And so what are the privacy rights for all of these people? Once you've got this dash cam, let's call it a dash cam recording, what privacy rights do they have? And the answer seems to be, from the court system right now, in the absence of a particular statute, there's no privacy rights. That's why you can get on YouTube and watch videos of officer-involved shootings where an officer shoots and kills somebody. You can see that on YouTube. That's why, because public records laws don't shield these recordings. And that's where the ACLU, and I'm picking on the ACLU here because I kind of feel I can. I've been a volunteer ACLU lawyer on and off in my career. That's where the ACLU finds itself in a conundrum. Because on one hand, the ACLU wants these recordings to be made to record potential police misconduct. On the other, it doesn't want the families of people or the people who were recorded themselves to be subjected to these videos being released on YouTube. And so I've seen the ACLU take the position in some state legislatures that, look, there's privacy rights for everybody but law enforcement officers. Well, that's not going to fly. That's not going to fly with a state legislature at all, I don't think. That's, you know, way too explicit a second-class treatment of law enforcement officers. But there doesn't seem to be an answer yet. We don't see legislatures coming to the fore to come up with a very kind of consistent exemption from disclosure for these videos. And the result is, until that happens, we're going to find cases like this one out of Seattle where you're going to have disclosure of all videos. The last case I want to talk about is not a recorded opinion or reported opinion. You can find it on our webpage along with the materials that go with this podcast. It's an arbitrator's decision, and normally I wouldn't be talking too much about an arbitrator's decision, but this is one that I think is really poignant because of the message that the arbitrator is giving to employers with respect to what they need to do in disciplinary investigations. This is a case that comes out of a Florida town, the city of Boynton Beach. Hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, Florida. And it's a case that had got a lot of publicity in Florida. It involved a police sergeant by the name of Frank Ranzi. And Ranzi had a history of being involved in the labor organization there, the PBA in Palm Beach County, and at times was involved in some fairly controversial issues on behalf of the PBA. Well, this whole mess, and I'll refer to it as a mess, and you'll hear why in just a moment, starts in 2012. And in 2012, Ranzi is changing assignments, and he, with the change in assignments, he gets a change in laptops. And these are laptops issued by the department. When Ranzi gets his new laptop, he assumes it's like the previous one. And the previous one was not Wi-Fi capable. And therefore, the only way you could get on the internet would be through a very restricted, what's called VPN, virtual private or virtual public network or private network, VPN protocol. You couldn't get in through normal Wi-Fi, and you had to get in through a password. Ranzi has 5 children who lived with him over the course of the summer of 2012. And he didn't have, he had a lot of alimony and child support payments and the like. So he didn't have access to a lot of electronic toys for his kids. So what he would do would be he would leave his work laptop at home so that his kids could use it to play games. And Ranzi isn't worried about internet access because he doesn't think there's any internet access because the only way you can get in is through password-protected VPN. So he and his kids didn't have the password, so he thought, no problem. So you know where this is going, right? The laptop was Wi-Fi capable. And in August of 2012, Ranzi notices that the laptop is not in its usual place. And he's told by his son, Frank, Dad, there's a little problem. I got a virus on the computer. Ranzi asks, how'd you get the virus? The son's answer, I was looking at porn over the summer. Ranzi challenges his son, says, that's not possible. And the son says, oh, yeah, it is. I just clicked on Internet Explorer. I didn't have to use the VPN. Ramsey immediately goes to the department, turns in his computer, and explains what has happened and says, look, there may be a virus on the computer. My son has gotten on porn sites. And very quickly, the department starts an internal affairs investigation and criminal investigation, apparently. That's not quite clear from this arbitrator's opinion. But it's at least an internal affairs investigation into whether or not Ramsey improperly accessed the internet for child pornography. Very quickly, information from the investigation leaks. And it leaks out onto local blogs. And what leaks is that Ramsey is the subject of a criminal investigation and, in fact, had child pornography on his computer. Ramsey is outraged, goes to the police chief, asks for an expedited investigation, and none of those things occurred. He also asked for an investigation into who leaked the information. That investigation doesn't occur. There is a thorough forensic investigation into the laptop, and it determines that there were pornographic images on the laptop, but none were of minors, and no child pornography sites had been visited. And it also determined that all of the pornography that was accessed in the first 2 hours of time when Ramsey was on duty. In other words, it wasn't Ramsey because he'd left his computer at home. Towards the end of the internal affairs investigation, the detective who is doing it is asked to give a presentation to senior officers of the department. The presentation contains huge errors in, and what the arbitrator eventually refers to as exaggerations, including assertions that the porn websites caused the virus, that 5,733 adult porn sites were visited. In fact, only 23 were, and only 6 of those even actually turned out to contain pornography. So lots of errors in the presentation that's given by the internal affairs investigation, the investigator. That doesn't stop the city manager from firing Ramsey. And he is fired for accessing pornographic sites on his webpage. Ramsey asks the city manager, asks the police chief, please interview my son. Please interview these other witnesses. They don't do so. So the case goes to arbitration, and the arbitrator, you can probably tell from my recitation of the facts, the arbitrator ends up reversing the termination and ordering that Ramsey be made whole for all lost wages and benefits, and the arbitrator issues a scathing opinion about the investigation. And here's where the message to the employer is. The arbitrator says, look, when somebody who's a key player in a disciplinary investigation suggests that you interview witnesses, you should interview witnesses. When that person tells you, look, you need to investigate certain facts, Ramsey had asked, look, you should investigate whether or not this laptop could have been used at my house to access Wi-Fi. The department didn't do that. The arbitrator says, look, you got to investigate these sorts of facts. You didn't even check into Ramsey's claim that others on his shift knew that he left his laptop at home. You didn't even look at his prior laptops to see whether or not they were Wi-Fi capable. In other words, you proceeded from a presumption of guilt, and all you attempted to do was to prove that the employee was guilty. The arbitrator, in essence, says here to the department, look, you know how to conduct an investigation. That's what you do for a living. You conduct investigations. You're a police department. You know the basic job of an investigator is to gather both exculpatory and inculpatory information. You try to prove that employee or that suspect guilty and you try to prove them innocent. And you didn't do that here. You proceeded from and never shook yourself away from the presumption of guilt. And the arbitrator refers to the employer's conduct here, and in particular, the city manager's lack of neutrality, as egregious. The arbitrator ends his opinion with this line: "Regrettably, it is not possible for this award to provide an appropriate remedy for the loss of personal reputation and the potential loss of future employability and earning capacity. All I can do," says the arbitrator, "is make Ramsey whole with full back pay and order that all of his benefits and his retirement be restored." This is, I think, a morality play, a lesson for employers. This one happens to be a spectacular case because it was public, because the arbitrator goes on at such great length about the need for a neutral investigation, and of course because of the facts, that makes it all the more spectacular. But what this arbitrator is saying is not unusual. You'll find this as a common theme in arbitrators' opinions. Do a thorough, complete, unbiased investigation. That's it for our July 1st Thursday podcast. This is Will Aitchison signing off. Well, I hope to see you in the next First Thursday at the start of August, unless we have some emergency podcast between now and then. Have a great summer.